Welcome, everyone, to our Parshas Vayetze class 5783, 2022, and we are titling the class The Art of the Con, as in con artist. So, as a little bit of a prelude, a little bit of context, we're going to use the last Parsha, Toldos, and this week's Parsha, Vayetze, and we're going to sort of merge the two together to give us a fuller picture of the question that we're asking tonight. You ready for the question? Here's the question. Jacob is defined as Emet. Emes, truth. He was Mr. Truth. We even say in the liturgy, in the davening, Titein Emes LeYaakov. God gave truth to Jacob. So the question is, if he's Mr. Truth, and even more than Mr. Truth, he seems to be defined by the rabbis as this Ish Tam, this simple, pure, good-hearted, straightforward individual. So when you analyze a statement that we're going to look at momentarily, the statement seems to countermand and contradict the notion of Jacob being Mr. Truth Teller. And it seems that either he's exaggerating in the extreme, as we'll see momentarily. So the question is, we're going to try to reconcile a statement made by Yaakov, Jacob, to his future bride, his Rachel, his Rachel, and we're going to try to make sense of how could it be a true statement. Are you ready? Let's begin with source number one. So for those of you who are on the Zoom, you can see the class sources in front of you. And let us begin. And I'll ask everyone once again online, on the Zoom, if you could please take a moment and just mute yourselves to make sure that we don't disturb the class. I would appreciate it. And then we'll have a Q&A, as we always do, questions and answers off the record. And sometimes the most interesting, fun, juicy materials are done off the record at the end of the class. So please, let's save for later any questions. Okay, so I'm, in order for expedience, even though I included the Hebrew at the top of the page, I'll just do the English. Okay, ready? Source number one. And it was, when Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, brother of his mother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob stepped forward and rolled the stone from upon the mouth of the well and watered the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. And here comes the outrageous statement. Hold on to your yarmulkes, shaitels, and hats. Then Jacob kissed Rachel, and he raised his voice and wept. Jacob told Rachel, and I put it in bold, just to make sure we wouldn't lose sight of this amazing statement. Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother, and that he was Rebekah's son. Then she, Rachel, ran, and she told her father, Lava. Well, what does it mean? This is source two now. What does it mean that Jacob was somehow the brother of Lava? What does that mean? Now, just pause for a moment. Before we look at Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, who is the great Torah commentator, it could be, superficially, that it's a similar statement when Abraham asks Sarah to say, if anyone asks about your marital status, say that you and I are kind of like brother and sister. Because where we come from, in that part of the world, which was present-day Turkey, Syria area, that's where Haran was, that's where we are. Our story takes place right now. In that part of the world, it was common for people who were close relatives to refer to themselves as brother and sister. Like Mishpacha, we're close family. We're MOTs. We're members of the tribe. M-O-T. So maybe that's what he means. Laban is the uncle of Jacob, because Jacob's mom was Rebekah. Rivka had a brother, an older brother. We already met him a couple parshas ago in Chayesara, and he was Laban, the con artist Laban. So maybe that's what he means. Nothing more, nothing less. But Rashi doesn't see it that way. Rashi makes a statement. What does it mean, brother? And furthermore, I don't know if you caught this. He says to Rachel, he identifies himself by two different people. Brother of her father Laban, and also the son of Rebecca. Now Rebecca would be Laban's sister, which means it's Rachel's aunt, because they're all related. So what does it all mean? Let's have a look at source 2, please. That he, Jacob, was her father's brother. He says to Rachel, this is the first time he ever meets Rachel, I am your dad's brother. That's not a true statement. It's not factually true. But what does it mean? A relative of her father, like in, we are men who are brothers. Like I said a moment ago, we're next of kin. Fine. But on a more complicated, complex level, he was implying something amazing. Ready? Its midrashic interpretation is. Now the midrash is the oral tradition. So it's not written in the Torah this way. It is explained by the rabbis this way. They're filling in the blanks that are missing from the Torah, which is the written word, the Torah Shebaksav. The Torah Shebalpeh, the oral tradition, is basically everything other than the written document. So the midrash says, Jacob was saying to Rachel, if Laban comes for deceit, I too am his brother in deceit. But if he is a decent person, I am also the son of Rebecca, his decent sister. Finished. Wow. So let me say the statement again. Jacob meets Rachel by the well. Do you remember Bambi? I don't know if you ever were allowed to watch Bambi. I'm old enough where I was allowed to watch Bambi before it became too traumatic for children. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Because apparently when the hunter kills Bambi's mom, it traumatized generations of children. I don't believe it, but who knows, right? So I know that Bambi got a bad rap, okay? When I was a kid, the only bad rap that Bambi ever had was that the creator of Bambi, Walt Disney, was an anti-Semite. That was the only thing negative I ever heard about Bambi. But we still went to see it.
I'm still sick over Old Yeller.
Right. We still went to see it. So when Bambi's mom is dead, so everyone in the movie, if you remember, falls in love at the same time. You have the flower, who I think was a skunk, and you have Bambi, the little deer, and then you had Thumper the rabbit. Thank you. Thumper the rabbit. Very good, Neil. So the three of them all are smitten. Do you remember the cute term they used? Twitter-pated. So, Jacob is Twitter-pated by Rachel. I mean, who wouldn't be? She was the most beautiful woman in the world at that time. So he was Twitter-pated. And he says, by the way, my dear, I'm ready to marry you. But, you know, I know dear old dad, your father, Laban, is Mr. Deceit. He's the cheater. He's probably going to put up impediments and roadblocks, and we're never going to be able to be married. But I want you to know something. And it's clear that he is responding to Rachel, because Rachel must have said to him, look, I'm willing to marry you, but sinishkronish helfet, nothing you do is going to work, because my dear old dad, bless his heart, will never let us be married. Whatever you think, my dad is the source of darkness in this world. He is the Emperor Palpatine of the world, for those Star Wars fans. The Emperor was the source of the darkness against the Jedis, the great Sith Lord. Well, my dad is a Sith Lord, and he will never allow us to be married. So you know what Jacob says? Really? Fear not, my love. We will get married. You see, I'm here as two different people. If your father, Laban, acts yashar, if he is on the upright with me, and he treats me with honesty and integrity. Yeah, right, sure. Then I will behave to him as a son of Rebecca with absolute honesty and integrity. I'm a product of Rebecca. But if he comes to me with the attitude of those perpetually going out of business electronic shop that they used to have in the 80s in New York City that were out of business for 10 years straight. You know, good luck trying to haggle with those guys, right? You walk in the door. I'll never forget, I was a yeshiva walker, and I went to New York, and I wanted desperately the cutting-edge technology. I'm really dating myself here, okay? Sorry about that. But you will all know what I'm referring to. Man. The greatest technology in the world that every yeshiva guy wanted in my yeshiva was a Sony Walkman. It was the best. We all wanted that Sony Walkman. It was like the iPhone before the iPhone, right? It was the best. So I never forget going into one of these perpetually going out of business places. And it was run by some Middle Eastern type guys. I don't think they were Jewish. They could have been Israelis. Probably not. They were our Arab brothers and sisters. And these guys had the Sony Walkman and the Iowa. Remember the Iowa? It was like the sister of the Sony Walkman. It was also a great contraption. Iowa was like A-I-W-A. So I go in there and I researched it. Because you know me, I'm a very detailed type person. So I knew exactly what the MSRP of a Sony Walkman should be. The manufacturer's suggested retail price before you have the Jinzu steak knives thrown in, right? So I know what I'm supposed to pay, right? So I go in and I see the Walkman is there. It's in a box. Now, the first thing you got to check when you get the box out the door is that, in fact, what you bought is in the box. Because it may not be Sony, it may be Sony, you know, from a factory somewhere that is related to Sony distantly. Anyways, so I see that there's an MSRP on the box. So the MSRP is supposed to be $200, $249. No, you know what the MSRP was? About $799. The only place in the world, I dare say, at that time where I would pay $799 for that would probably be like if I was the king of Saudi Arabia and I didn't care. Like inflation. Okay. But $799. You're right? And it was crossed out. There was a line through the $799 because you're not going to pay that price. And underneath it, it had $599. And again, there was a line marking it off. You're not going to pay $599. Nobody would pay $599, right? I could walk into the Sony store and pay less. So here I want to haggle. I want to bargain. So underneath the seven and the five, $399. And that was the starting point for the negotiating process. And so I negotiated for about 25 seconds, and I realized, you know what? I'm really out of my depth here. Because no matter how good I think I am, this guy is probably a great-grandson of Lavan. And I'm going to walk out poor with a probably non-functional, non-working Sony Walkman. I'm better off just, you know, biting the bullet, as I say, and going to the Sony store or to, like, Bloomingdale's or Macy's and just pay the MSRP, and I have a place to stand behind it. So that's what I did, okay? But I learned my lesson. So that was Lavan's family. Lavan is one of those guys who would work those stores, you know, and they would look at you, my Israeli Jewish friend, come here. I have this Walkman, you know. And they're good, right? Lavan is a great guy. So what does Yaakov say? Look, Rachel, I love you. And I hear your fear that Dad's going to play a little chicanery game here. I get it. But I'm up to the task. If Dad wants to be Yashar with me, if he wants to be upfront, I'm a son of Rebecca. I will behave accordingly with integrity and honesty. If he's up to Lavan, the Ramai, the cheater, I'm there. What does that mean? Jacob, you're going to be the equal of Lavan Ha'arami? His literal name is Lavan the Aramean. So what did the rabbi say it means? His name was Lavan the deceiver, Lavan the con man. When your name is in the Torah, given to you by God, it's a narrative description. You are the cheater. You know, I gotta give all hands off. Hold on to your wallets, gentlemen and ladies, because when you're with Lavan, you ain't gonna win. So what kind of statement is that? How outrageous is that? Let's look now at source 3, and this compounds the question tenfold. Ready? The two brothers, this is where last week's parsha comes into play, source 3. the two brothers grow up. And I'll read it in Hebrew. It says, Vayigdalu hane'arim, the lads, the youths, as they would say in my cousin Vinny, the youths grew up. Vayehi Esav, Ish Yodet Sayid, and Esau became a man who knows hunting. Ish Sodeh, a man of the field. V'Yaakov, but Jacob, Ish Tam, was a wholesome man, a pure man. Yoshev Ohalim, who dwells in tents of learning. He's a Yeshiva Bacher, very wet behind the ears. Now, in case you weren't sure what it means to be a man who knows hunting and a man who is a wholesome individual, look at source 4 and 5. Rashi defines it for us. You ready? So what does it mean Esau was a man who knows hunting? Let me ask you a question. If all the Torah wanted to impart to us was that Esau was a master hunter, why would it say a man who knows hunting? Just say a man who's a hunter. What do you mean, yodea, that he knows? Do you hear the question? It should just simply say he was a hunter. But by adding the extra layer that he knows hunting, it seems to be playing on two different levels. Yes, it's true. He was a formidable hunter. Bow and arrow, he and Robin Hood, they're the best. But there's a second level to his hunting. It wasn't just literal, this is for you, Barry, but metaphorical. That the hunting that he did was not with bow and arrow, but with his mouth and manipulation of his words. He was a con guy. He could manipulate people, get people to hear him, but he would deceive people. How do we know this? Because Rashi says, look at source 4. To ensnare and to deceive his father Isaac with his mouth. He, Esau, would ask, Father, oh, I am so holy. I want to know, how do we tie salt and straw? And then his father Isaac would be under the impression, oh my gosh, Esau, what a tzaddik my son Esau is. What a righteous guy. He's meticulous about keeping the letter of the law. By the way, you don't take tithes, which is a tenth of the produce, from things that are not produced by the earth. Salt and straw are not products that are naturally born. They're created, so therefore you don't tithe either of them, especially salt. Therefore, the question was a moot question. But he wanted to show his dad, hey, I'm not just about tithing money or shipala. I'm so meticulous. Do I have to take tithes from salt, Dad? And his father thought, wow, what a question. It means he's really scrupulous in his observance, which, of course, is the opposite. So he would use his formidable brain. Esau was a very smart guy. But he would use it to manipulate and deceive dear old father, Isaac. Now, what about Jacob, the wholesome one? Remember, Esau was the hunter. Jacob is the Ishtam, the simple, wholesome son. So listen to Rashi's definition in source 5. He is not an expert in all these things that Esau is expert. He doesn't know how to use his mouth to manipulate and to lie and to con. But as is his heart, so is his mouth. One who is not sharp in deceiving is called wholesome. So in other words, he is the antithesis, if you will, of Esau. So let me ask you, let's just stop for a moment. If Esau showed up at that well, and he's the one getting the girl, and he says out loud to the girl, it would be Leah, by the way, he was supposed to marry. So let's say he meets Leah in our fantasy alternate world. Let's say he meets Leah by the well, and he says out loud, Esau, you know, I know about your dear old dad Lavan, but hey, I'm the one who knows how to hunt. And if your dad wants to play those games, I'm the one who knows how to hunt. I would believe him 100%. I'd say, yes, Esau, bravo, we're cheering for you, pal. You of anybody maybe could stand up to Lavan and his machinations, right? But for Jacob, the goody-two-shoes, the wholesome one, to brag to Rachel, his betrothed, or the one he loves, the Twitter-baited one, oh my gosh, I could be good, but if your old dad wants to play games, I'm the ultimate game player. Seriously? Now again, Jacob is MS. He doesn't lie. So we have to just take this statement as a statement of fact. It's not an untruth. It's not even an exaggeration. How? How's this possible? Okay. Before we go on, let me point something out. If you look carefully at source 3, I'll read it to you again with a little more care. Ready? I'll translate as we read it. This is source number 3. It's in the Hebrew above. It only works in the Hebrew. Ready? Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim. The lads grew up. Vayihi Esav. And Esav became Ish Yodea Tzayid, a man who knows hunting, Ish Sadeh, a man of the field. V'Yaakov and Jacob, Ish Tam, Yoshev Ohalim, was this wholesome man who dwelt in tents. Do you notice there's the word Ish there? A man who is wholesome? Again, it seems superfluous. The word Ish, what's it doing there? Why don't I just make a statement? If all Jacob was as Rashi defines him, a man who doesn't know how to deceive, then why not say the following? Ready? The Yaakov and Jacob, Tam. He's simple. He's wholesome. Yoshev Olim, he dwelt in tents. What's this man who is wholesome? We already know he's a guy. There's no identity issues here. So why add the word Ish? Ah, so could be, I'm throwing this out for your edification and for your thought, that by adding the word Ish, maybe it's giving us a window into the true nature of Jacob. Maybe he's not the simpleton that we think he is. Meaning, because it says he's an Ish Tam, a man who is wholesome, maybe the word Ish is adding something, layering the nature of the potentiality of who Jacob could be. So in other words, if he was just Tom, a simple, wholesome guy, all bets are off. That's how he is 24/7, 100% of the time. But if he's an Ish Tom, maybe it's telling us that he could select the time and the place to be a Tom, wholesome, but if the conditions didn't warrant Tamimistic behavior, wholesome behavior, he was capable of being surreptitious, of being a little, in other words, he's not the simple guy. He was wily, not as in coyote, because he never won. By the way, I had a lot of joy when I was in Philadelphia for the first time. Do you know they have an actual chain of food stores there called Acme? My only reservation is that I didn't see the Roadrunner's picture, like up on the, you know, on the Acme store. But I always want
Acme,
right. I don't know if they have Acme here, but the Acme is like, do they?
Yeah.
And they have supermarkets. So I'm wondering to myself. First of all, it always bothered me as a kid. I said to my mom once, I said, "Ima, I have a question on the Roadrunner." She said, "Come on, seriously, you're going to ask me about the Roadrunner?" I said, "Well, let me ask you. If he's out in the middle of the desert somewhere in Arizona or Nevada, right? Yeah. Okay." So, he's hungry and he wants the Roadrunner, yeah? The coyote wants the Roadrunner, yeah? Okay. He can get the world, this is way before Amazon, right? He can get air dumped in front of him. Anything from tanks to missiles to bombs. Why can't he get a pizza delivered if he's hungry? So my mom said, you know what, can't ask that question. He wouldn't have a cartoon. I'm thinking to myself, at some point, Mr. Wiley E., after you've been thrown off that cliff 100 times, give up on the Roadrunner. Get some fried chicken, right? The KFC delivery guy. If they can deliver a bomb, the nuke, I'm sure they can find a way to deliver you some food. Anyways, that was my question. So Acme is, again, the wily coyote, okay? So Jacob could be the wily one as the Ish Tam, meaning when he's an Ish Tam, he has power and command over the attribute of wholesomeness. He's not just Tom. He's the master of Tom. So if you're a master of simple, wily, you can do both. So in other words, if he's dealing with the going out of business perpetual place in New York, and he's haggling over the price of that Sony Walkman, Jacob has the Wiley part, and he can haggle, he can hold his own. But when he was with Abraham and Isaac and the good people, he's the Tom, he's the Yeshiva boy. So he had potential. Okay, but that doesn't suffice. You know why? It's one thing to say that Jacob always had potentiality to sort of have mastery over the attribute of wholesomeness. But it's another thing entirely to play in the league of the dark master love on himself. In other words, we're not just talking about Esau. And I think Jacob did very well against Esau. And in fact, Esau, even he recognizes his own brother's Ishtam, that he also was deceiver, you know? He says out loud, when he discovers, Esau, that Jacob dressed up in the subterfuge of getting the blessings, he says out loud, ha! Hachi kara shmo Yaakov. That is why they call the name of my goody two-shoes brother Jacob. Vayagveni famayim. He has healed me. He's underhanded me, not once now, but twice. First, he sold me that shalant for my birthright, you know, the red bean shalant. He manipulated me, I realize in retrospect. And now, he got my blessings from dear old dad, again, through subterfuge. And the heel, of course, is located at the bottom of your body. So it's sort of synonymous with being underhanded. Whereas the name Yisrael, Israel, which is his new name that he conquers the angel with, what's the first part of Yisrael? Yashar, Yashrus, being upright, being honest, Israel. But we always have the side, right? We have the side of Jacob, the potential to understand the enemy and to not be duped. And we have the Yashrus, the potential for acting upright with the bad guys. Okay, so again, let's get back to our original question. We are on the Dera, we're on the road again, to gaining truth in how Jacob's statement that we found outlandish, when he sees Rachel by the well, he says, if dear old dad wants to behave as dear old dad likes to behave with duplicity and chicanery, achi avia, I am your dear old dad's brother, I'll take him to the cleaners. And you know what the irony is? He took him to the cleaners, right? At the end of 20 years, when Jacob runs away with Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah and 11 of the children, and Laban pursues him, what did Jacob have? Every sheep, 100 times or more, dear old father-in-law Laban, unilaterally changed their deal. Spotted and speckled sheep, pure sheep, whatever, it didn't matter. Jacob took him to the cleaners. He had everything. So in the end, Jacob didn't just brag. He did it. He performed. How? How did he do this? Where did the source come from? Let's look at number 5. So at the beginning of our parsha, now I skipped to the story of Rachel, Jacob meeting at the well, but let's go backwards just a little bit. So our parsha opens, and it says, Vayetze Yaakov, Jacob leaves home because mom and dad are fearful of a confrontation. Esau is angry beyond words at being wronged by Jacob. And they fear the two brothers will clash and murder each other. And Rebekah and Isaac are fearful of this, so therefore they kind of send Jacob to exile. Go to Laban's house, Rebekah says. My brother, you'll get a wife there. Yeah, but 20 years, he never saw his mom again, which is very tragic for poor Jacob. He saw dad, yes, but he never was reunited with his mother, Rebekah, sadly. So he leaves home, and he's on his way to Turkey, Syria area, north of Israel. And he walks or goes past the future site of the Beit HaMikdash, the Temple Mount, where the Western Wall is, the Kotel. And it says actually he went past it and forgot to pray. He comes back. And at that point, God supernaturally causes the sun to set early to prevent Jacob from leaving. And it becomes like a hotel for him. And he rests there on a stone and he lies down and he has this incredible dream. And there's angels going up and they're going down. And he sees a future vision. God's angel's talking to him and says, Jacob, I know you're going to exile, but I promise you where you're sitting now, the land everywhere is going to belong to your children one day. It's going to be Israel. And he gives him future neviut, future prophecies, beautiful stuff. Okay, so let's have a look. Number six.
What is the relevance of sleeping on stones?
We'll talk after the class, when we're off the, when we finish. Q&A. Thank you, Barry. He, Jacob, encountered Mount Moriah, which is the Temple Mount, and spent the night there because the sun had set. He took from the stones of the place and he put them around his head. This is not exactly the My Pillow type ad, I'm sorry. And lay down in that place. And he lay down in that place. Right, we want a Tempur-Pedic mattress. And what do you mean he lay down in that place? So Rashi, look at source 7, says, this expresses exclusion. It's an exclusion. Yotso, it's take something out. In that place, at the Mount Moriah, future site of the temple, Jacob lay down. But during the 14 years that he served in the house of Aver, he did not lay down at night because he was occupied with the study of Torah. Whoa. What is this coming from? What do you mean? I thought Jacob left home. And then, a couple days later, he encounters Rachel at the well. But apparently it didn't happen like this. Rashi is quoting the oral tradition. You know what happened? Jacob leaves home, and he's on his way to the house of Laban. But he makes a pit stop. He goes to the yeshiva, the house of learning, that was set up by Shem and Aver. Now, who was Shem? Shem was Noah's son, the good guy. We're all descendants of Shem. Remember, he had three sons, Noah did. Shem, Cham, and Yafes. And we, the Jewish people, the Arabs and many others, we all descend from Shem. So Shem and Shem's grandson, Aver, set up a house of study, a yeshiva. Now, again, I have to clarify for you in a moment, what does a yeshiva look like back then? It doesn't have a whole library of Gemaras and Mishnahs, and because none of that existed, right? So what is a house of study? What's a house of learning? Furthermore, why did he have to go there to learn Torah when he was taught by the greatest Torah scholars in the world? His grandfather, Abraham, taught Jacob for 15 years all the secrets of the Torah. Who's better than Abraham as a rabbi, as a teacher? Nobody. And then his own father, Isaac, took over and educated Jacob. So what Torah could you possibly get from these two descendants of Noah who have this sort of exile little yeshiva, little house of study somewhere? What Torah would Jacob be in need of? In other words, he has Abraham's Torah and Isaac's Torah. That's pretty good. I mean, if I had an opportunity, any of us had an opportunity to learn Torah from Abraham and Isaac, bravo. I mean, there's nothing better than that. Yes, so
there
why?
Is. There is.
It was a pretty
so why?
Torah.
The saying is when you have two rabbis together, you always get a third opinion.
Right. You get a third opinion. Very well said, Barry. So maybe he wanted that third opinion. But why would he go to Shem and Abraham? In other words, what did the descendants of Noah have to do with it? He spent 14 years there. And you know how he fell asleep? He fell asleep like over his books. Well, whatever learning he was doing. Now, let's just back up. A couple of people in our shul and one of my previous shuls in Poughkeepsie, they always asked me. They said, Rabbi. Of course, when I was in Memphis, that's how they talked. They said, Rabbi. Come on, you got to love it. Rabbi, can you please explain to me what is a yeshiva of Shem and Aver look like? What does that mean? So I gave them an analogy. Ready for a great analogy? It would be like Plato University. Now, clearly, Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato taught amazing, amazing ideas, philosophy that was transcended. It was the best. But there wasn't a physical location of Plato University. There wasn't a campus and a sorority and a fraternity and a study hall. No, what did they do at Plato University? If you wanted to go learn with Plato, You would walk with the master if he would take you on as a student. And the two of you would spend time together. You know, you'd be walking in the sun and you know, and you'd go on a little walk and a journey for an hour, and he would tell over some philosophies with you, and you and he, if you were up to that caliber of learning, he would share with you ideas about the world and the operation of the world. Beautiful. That's what the yeshiva Shemin Eberworth was like. In other words, it wasn't a conventional yeshiva where the guys come and dorm and they have like a house to study of base matters. It was probably much more philosophical. Okay. But again, why did Jacob need this? He had the Torah of Abraham and Isaac. This is before he went to Laban's house. So I like to offer to you the following. The reason that Jacob needed to go to Shem and Aver, there was something in his inventory of learning that was lacking. The Torah that Shem and Aver could teach him, that his own Zaidi, Abraham, and his own father, Isaac, could not teach him. You know what that was? The Torah of exile. Think about it. Abraham was the master of Torah of Israel. Isaac never left Israel. His Torah, the scope and everything involved, was pure, the Torah of Israel. Jacob had mastery over that Torah. He was a master. But you know, something in his resume was missing. What about a Jewish individual who's exiled? Remember, this exile of Jacob for 20 years of Laban is foreshadowing all future exiles that his children, us, would have to experience when we were no longer living in Israel, when we were exiled to parts of the world unknown, whether it was, you know, from Israel after number one temple, we went to Babylonia, we came back 7 years later. After the Romans destroyed temple number two, we've never gone back. I mean, now we're back in Israel, but we don't have a temple three, so we're still considered de facto as if we're in Galut, as if we're in exile. But be that as it may, I want to offer the following. Jacob's greatness was lacking something that Shaman Aver could give him, that no one else could give him. So for 14 years, he was a student of Shaman Aver. Now think about the world that Shaman Aver lived in. Shame lived in a time where giants were there before the flood, the antediluvians, and they were pillaging the world. And he survived magically, one of eight people to survive on the ark, on the Teva. And then Aver, his grandson, lived in the time of the Dor HaPlaga, the generation of the Tower of Babylon and King Nimrod and all that horrible stuff that was going along. And those two individuals, Shem and Aver, they kept their integrity, their honesty, and their greatness intact. They did not allow influence from the generation before the flood or the generation after the flood, the post-diluvian world. No. So that's what they gave Jacob. So Jacob studied and studied and studied. But you know what he studied? He studied with Ricky Jay. I don't know if you know who Ricky Jay was. He died, unfortunately, last year, but he was the world's greatest sleight of hand magician and card shark. If you go on YouTube, not now, please, you will see Ricky Jay. He had a Broadway performance called Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants, the deck of cards. And he could do things nobody else, I think, in history could do. But Ricky Jay was a good guy. Jewish guy, by the way. One of ours. One of the MOTs. So listen to this. During those 14 years, this is when Jacob fulfilled the potential that we mentioned at the outset. As in Ishtam, remember? The one who would know how to apply situationally whether I need to be wholesome or not wholesome. And he didn't have the potential realized until he goes for 14 years to the yeshiva and he studies by the masters, Shem and Aver. And then he goes to Laban's house and he turns up with Rachel. He says, look, sweetheart, I love you, and I know you fear that dad's going to win. Fear not. I am armed and ready. I have the Torah of Abraham and Isaac, and he wants to be a Rebekah with me, honest and above board. I'm there. But if he wants to go to the bag of tricks and be Laban, the deceiver, the Ramai, I'm ready. I spent 14 years, sweetheart, learning the yeshiva. I learned by the best. Ricky Jay taught me every card trick. I can do it all, and I will one-up your father. And I believe this is the nature of the truth of Jacob. So in other words, when he says his statement, I am your dear dad's brother, he's saying, if need be, I will perform and act like a deceiver if your dad, Lavan, gives us no choice. But if he wants to behave upright, I'm there also. So he had the duality of both. And I believe it was given to him. Now, it's not just Jacob that received this. We have received this gift. Again, I'm not saying you should go to the Mohegan Sun Casino tonight. Okay, unless Ricky Jay's there with you, then you'll win. But this is what it means. Why are we sitting around a table and on Zoom after 2,000 years of darkness, of exile? As Mark Twain famously said, it's the greatest miracle that the Jewish people even are around today. It's a miracle. We're 14 million people in a world where we went through pogroms and inquisitions and Holocaust. How is this possible? You know why it's possible? Because Jacob gave us the genetics to make it possible. It's delightful, right? In other words, every society we live in, we have the potentiality in our genes. We could be the grandchildren of Rebecca, the upright one, and behave wholesomely. But Jacob, with those 14 years, bestowed the genetic gift to us to survive the darkness of exile, because we also have the ability to recognize chicanery and how to one-up the manipulator, the con artist. And I want you to think, and I'll close with this thought and we'll get to our questions. I didn't call him a deceiver in the class name. We call him a con man. And there's something unique about a con man. And my rabbi says this is probably what Jacob was a master of. You ready for this? What's the difference between a con guy and, let's say, somebody who is a three-card Monty player in Times Square? So a three-card Monty guy, he cheats you, but he doesn't make any pretense of being your friend. He has a game of chance, it's rigged, and you're an idiot because you think you can win. Okay, no, you were duped. Fine, mazel tov. But you know what a con man does? A confidence man or woman first has to gain your confidence, and then they steal your stuff. But it's a decidedly different, much more sophisticated game. A con man has to be intimately aware of you and what you want. And once they tap into your desires and who you are and what you're looking for, then they can con you, because they create an elaborate game that will be it'll be for you. It'll be unique, yours and yours alone. A great confidence man won't be found out until after the con is played. Like, remember the great movie, one of the greatest of all time, The Sting.
Yeah.
Right? One of the all-time greatest movies. The con worked, and when, I think it was Robert Shaw, he didn't even know leaving that he had been conned. It was all Paul Newman and Robert Redford and all their compatriots. A great con takes months to pull it off, and it's laborious, but it's there. But what does a con man understand? He understands intimately who you are and what you want. This is what Jacob did. So let's back up. He gave Esau what Esau wanted. What did Esau want? He didn't want to be Israel. He didn't want to keep the Torah. He wanted a way out from being the responsible Bechor firstborn. So what did Jacob say to him? Here's a nice pot of beans, dear brother. How about you trade it for that birthright? He gave him an excuse to sort of justify not being the religious Jew, which is exactly what Esau was looking for. What does dear Uncle Laban want from him? Well, it's very simple. He wants Jacob to be with him and to work for him, because he realizes that Jacob's there, God blesses his animals, and they have lots of animals. So his stock portfolio, his literal stock portfolio, is going to increase tenfold. So what does Laban want? You know what he wants? He wants Jacob to work for him, but he doesn't want to have to pay him, which is exactly what Jacob says. What do you want to pay me? Nothing. I just want your daughters in marriage. Don't pay me anything. No salary. I just want the girls. So Laban's thinking probably, what an idiot. I would have given him, 50% of the stock. All he wants are Rachel Leah. Considerate, Go ahead. Sure. It doesn't cost me anything. I would have married them off to other guys. You want to be a sucker? There's a sucker born every day. So in other words, Jacob knew the mind of love on. Therefore, when he says, I can treat dear old dad whatever he wants, he's not trying to out-con Laban. You can't out-con Laban. Do you know what Jacob did? He held up a mirror. And he knew, by looking in that mirror, what did each individual in his life, what was Esau desirous of? Freedom from responsibility of the yoke of Torah and God. What does Laban want? Freedom from having to pay him anything. But he wants the blessing of God to make him rich. And to everyone in his life, he gave him back. He reflected back to them their own needs. Again, I believe that as the Jewish people, we always strive to be the Jacob son of Rebekah. But when we're dealing with enemies and with duplicity in our history, we're also up to the challenge of relating to the Labans of the world. And I believe that this Parsha, more than anything else, and what we just learned tonight, is the gift from Jacob that keeps on giving, and is the singular reason why we're around the table learning Torah 2,000 years after the exile from the temple. So I want to wish everyone a Laila Tova, good evening.